Okay, let's. Okay, let's go ahead and get started. Let's go ahead and get started in the back. So, what's your next major deadline coming up? Hardware prototype. When's that? Okay, so the procedure for that will be the same as what we followed last time, which is you'll be expected to make an appointment with your course coordinator, and we want your advisors present. For this second one, it's particularly important that your advisors be present. So we're going to watch that closely. So make sure you get with your advisors and tell them it's mandatory. Any feedback on the PDRs? What? Yeah, the mechanical, Dr. Cohen's teams haven't gotten their grades yet. I'm working on it. Sorry about that. Any other issues that we want to discuss before we get into today's lecture? Well, we have a lot of people missing today, I see. What? Which game?
The golf.
All right, well, we won't do a quiz, but... But I did actually want to, so today I want to talk about a little bit about experimental design from a pretty high level point of view. How many of you have had some probability and statistics in your program? I know the ECE students have. What about the other two departments? What course do you typically see your probability and statistics? I'm sorry?
Probability and statistics.
And is that in the math department or? And what level course do you, what semester do you take that in?
Sophomore.
And what kinds of things did they cover there? You don't even remember.
A lot of storytelling.
Gambling, horse racing, yeah. All the good stuff.
Blackjack.
All right, well, guess what? Unfortunately, now's the time when your investment in probability and statistics. If we could, it's a little bit noisy in here, so I don't want to have to shout too loud, so please either take your discussions outside or whatever, but I do want to go through this material, and this is a little more theoretical, if you will, than we've usually talked about. But it's important because many of you are going to get up on your final presentation and say, we went into the lab, we measured our system, and it met our design constraints. And here's the measurement that we took. 6 pounds or 3.5 this or that. What's wrong with that argument? And that's what I want to talk about today. It's not measured multiple times. And why is it important to measure multiple times?
Find the sources of variability.
Why? Let's see, because you need statistical significance? And maybe you need to do statistical modeling, too. Now, why is that important? Sources of variability are very important. Why? All right, if we could keep the discussions in the back down, please. Sudi? Okay, so variability is good. I mean, it's good we've got that concept, but I want to talk about this from a different point of view, from the point of view of whether you met your design constraints. So from an evaluation point of view, not so much from a design point of view. So let's start with one of my favorite topics, concrete. Because I can't talk about circuits, so we'll talk about concrete. We could. So here's a bag of 80-pound mix from Home Depot or wherever. What's in this bag? What's in the bag?
Specific nature of
concrete. What's in the bag? Yeah, concrete, but what? Concrete mix. What's concrete mix? Where's our civil engineers? Raise your hands. They're supposed to know this. I'm told you guys are all experts on concrete. What? Some aggregate. Good. That's actually one of the things in the bag. What else? What?
Sand.
Good. Porcelain cement. Close. Good. Which, and actually, there's probably some lime in there. Now, this bag says 80 pounds. What does that mean? That's what we want to talk about today. If I delivered that pallet of concrete and I weighed each bag, what would they weigh? And, you know, you're laughing about this, but you've all picked that bottle of soft drink because the level's just a little bit higher than the one next to it. Right?
On average on the pallet is 58 pounds.
On the average of the pallet. So there's about
8 bags per layer. With a very little variance.
8 bags per layer and what? Two?
5 layers, so 40 bags.
40 bags. Okay, the average of that pallet's going to be 80 pounds. How much are each bag going to vary? How tightly do you think they control that 80 pounds? By an ounce? A pound? Was there? A pound's not a bad guess. Why should we worry about this? Why should you worry about this as engineers? Well, we might call that profit margin.
Yeah. But it's not smart to have
to What?
If you're getting exactly that super
amount,
it changes your mix.
Changes your mix. How so?
Because the proportions are all set with the assumption that you have 80 pounds. You have a certain amount. So you add a certain amount of water based on that.
So actually, the weight may not be our biggest concern. What might be our biggest concern?
The distribution of the different amounts.
Why?
Because all of that is very specific in terms of strength.
So what if you're on a large civil engineering project, like you're building a road or something, what's your ultimate performance measure probably going to be?
Strength,
right? You'll have PSI and compression, I guess, the two things I hear talked about a lot. So why we must worry about this? We actually don't care that each bag is a pound off or up over. I mean, that's sort of natural. But what we do care about is that when we mix up that entire pallet of concrete, we get something that is within the specs of our project, meets our design constraints. So what's actually in this bag at a high level is 32 pounds of aggregate, and this is a 2-2-1 mix, 32 pounds of sand and 16 pounds of Portland cement. Now that doesn't tell you much, because the sand, of course, could vary, the aggregate could vary. But at a high level, that's what you've got in there. Now, precisely do you think those mixes are measured? Well, again, certainly not down to an ounce or a tenth of an ounce. In fact, if we took this 32 pounds of sand, if we took each bag and measured the amount of sand in that bag, what might we expect to see? If we took every bag and measured the amount of sand in it and plotted the weight of that sand and did a histogram, what might we expect to see? Uniform distribution? No.
Normal.
What?
Normal.
Normal. Excellent. We would hope the mean would be approximately 32, right?
32 pounds. So you're telling me one of the bags is going to be zero?
Well, we're going to get to that. Yes, it will actually be zero. I bought a case of 7 Up the other day, and one of the cans was empty. No. It's going to be Gaussianly distributed. Almost everything in life is Gaussianly distributed. Well, there's other types of distributions that occur in nature, but roughly speaking, it's going to be Gaussian. It might be skewed a little because, as you point out, it's not likely you're going to get zero. So, what controls the variance of this distribution? And why would you, as a cement manufacturer, worry about the variance of that distribution? Why would you, as a profitable cement manufacturer, worry about the variance of that distribution? I don't lose too much sleep over that. They've been mixing concrete for hundreds of years.
So if you have a bad distribution, so you got constant complaints?
Why do you, as a manufacturer, worry about that variance? Okay, let's sort of turn that around from a profit point of view. What is it going to cost you to drive that variance to zero in terms of machining? We could drive that variance to zero. We could make sure every bag that rolls off the line is exactly 80 pounds in exactly that mix down to a tenth of an ounce. Why are we not going to do that? No, not time.
Money.
That's going to cost you money. So how are we going to decide what that variance should be? And these are the kinds of things you have to worry about as design engineers.
I was going to say, if it was too high, then you'd be losing money. And if you focus too hard on it being exact,
so who's going to prescribe what that variance should be? The strength? But you can sort of set that variance to anything you want. The customer. You're ultimately going to have specs from your customers on what their variations they're willing to tolerate. And then you're going to set that variance to meet those specs. So eventually, as you're in this business long enough, you'll figure out what kind of a variance your customers are willing to tolerate before they start complaining about your cement mix. Now, what are some of the things that you can control in that variance? What are some of the things that are going to cause that variance? Even if you measure the weight of your ingredients down to a tenth of an ounce, the performance of this concrete is still going to vary. Why?
Human error.
No.
Why?
You don't control how much water is lost.
The customer puts in the water.
What?
And the customer put in the water.
And what about the water? What about the sand, for example, with respect to water? The absorptivity of the sand may vary. It's hard to control really precisely the chemical properties of these materials. So you're always going to have some variance, and driving that variance to zero is going to be very expensive. So we have to rethink the problem a little bit. The goal isn't just to drive the variance to zero, because that may be pointless. Well, what are the goals? Well, when you look at this bag of concrete and you look at the technical specifications for it, here are a few things that define essentially the performance of that concrete. The setting time, the PSI, and this ASTM spec on compressive strength. Now, what are going to influence some of these things?
The ratio of the mix.
What else?
Water added.
The absorptivity of some of these materials and the amount of water that you have to add.
The temperature.
Temperature is a big one. In fact, if you've actually poured lots of concrete, you know temperature is a big one. So how are we going to deal with this? These are our design constraints, and I want to focus on PSI today. We know there's going to be variations in our materials. How are we going to deal with this? You as the concrete manufacturer.
You're probably going to make the numbers faster than find the lowest or average number.
What major are you? Civil. Yeah, see, I get a lot of that we're going to do this experimentally. And that's actually true, that we'll do some of that. But let's talk about this more from an engineering design point of view. What?
Design conservatively, always.
No, that's going to cost us money.
That's actually required, though.
Yeah,
I mean. Manufacturers without a track record have to have a factor applied to the PSI they're shooting for.
Really?
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, that's. But let's talk more from an engineering modeling and design point of view. What kind of simulations?
It seems to be the answer to everything.
It is the answer to everything. So, PSI ultimately is some function of the ingredients and a bunch of other conditions. I'll give you that piece. We all would agree on that, correct? That's why you go to cement mixing school. Well, let's think about this function. What kind of function might this be? How might we actually estimate and measure this function? So we had the comment about going into the lab and mixing up batches. Tell me about that. Well, what's one of the first questions you want to ask about this function? You're all engineers. You've had a lot of math.
Is it a linear relationship?
Is it linear or nonlinear? Absolutely. You probably have, if you haven't figured this out already, most of what you deal with in your undergraduate program are linear approximations to real systems. Undergraduate engineering is actually all about linear analysis. Linear functions are the first order approximation to how most real systems behave. And then when you go to graduate school, you kind of learn the other side of how we can do things in a more nonlinear way. So let's assume a simple linear model that the PSI is some function of some constant alpha times the percent sand, the percent aggregate, and we'll assign factors for all those other things. And now we've got a model of PSI as a function of the ingredients. Why is this important to us from a manufacturing point of view? Why is this important? Why is this function, why is having some model of this important to you if you're a cement manufacturer?
Repeatability.
Control, repeatability. In what sense? So we said our goal is to produce concrete, which when mixed properly gives us this certain PSI.
Different variations.
How are we going to ensure that as a manufacturer?
Testing.
So what does a cement plant look like?
It's a mess. Sand and powder.
Where does the sand come from? So things go in, right? Sand goes in, rock goes in, porcelain cement, I guess, goes in. And what comes out is a mix of these things. How are you going to ensure that your output is within spec? You can do testing after the fact, but that gets to be very expensive, and that doesn't give you the ability to really control things. What's the more logical thing to do when you have a model like this? Not quite. I think the answer to this is pretty straightforward. You're overthinking this. Plug in numbers. What numbers? But where do those come from? So the train pulls up with train loads of sand. What are you going to do? You're going to measure the properties of the sand. You're going to plug those into this model. You're going to hope that what comes out is the correct PSI. And when the properties of a particular batch fluctuate, you might try to offset that through the mixing process. Generally speaking, one of the first steps in dealing in quality control, which is what we're talking about, is you try to control the inputs. You make sure that your suppliers are supplying you with components that are within certain specifications. And how do we do that? Well, there's something called sensitivity analysis, which we used to spend a lot more time on in engineering. We don't teach this as much, but you can essentially differentiate this function with respect to its arguments, and you can predict how much the output will vary as a function of the input, and then you can plug in the variances of the input, and you can predict then what the variance of the output's going to be. You can also figure out which of the components is most critically dependent on the quality of the output is most critically dependent on which of the inputs. This is a very standard form of engineering, particularly if you deal with quality control. And many of you, if you haven't figured it out yet, are probably going to end up in jobs dealing with quality control and testing. So this very simple analysis gives us insight into how outputs vary as a function of the variations of the inputs. And it will help you decide where you need to put your resources in terms of controlling quality. So that's sort of sensitivity analysis in a nutshell. But now we have a problem. We talked about the fact that any one of these parameters that we're measuring is going to vary according to a Gaussian distribution. So the question is, how do we interpret these measurements that we take on our materials? So the train load rolls up with the sand, and you measure it, and you say, well, the absorptivity is 3.1. You scoop it. I don't know how you do this. Do anybody of our civil engineers know how they actually do this? I don't know. You take a cup of this stuff, and you put it in some chemical analyzer, and you get a number out. And you say, and you're done, right? One measurement. No. We have to worry about how we're going to measure those inputs. So what we would like is a measurement or a result which is statistically significant. If in your final presentations you roll in and say, we measured once, and therefore we meet your design constraints, you're done. That's not a statistically significant measurement. And I'll explain why in a moment through a simple example. A result is called statistically significant if it is unlikely to have occurred by chance. Very simple concept, but probably one you'll hopefully understand a little bit better after today's lecture. A statistically significant difference means there's statistical evidence that there's a difference. Simple statement, but we can actually put some mathematics to that. It does not mean the difference is necessarily large, important, or significant in the common meaning of the word. And that's what I want to drive home today, what this actually means to say your result is statistically significant. The significance level of a test is traditionally based on the notion of hypothesis testing. This is why you learn about statistics. In simple cases, it's defined as the probability of making a decision to reject what's called the null hypothesis when the null hypothesis is actually true. And we classify these kinds of decisions in terms of what we often call type 1 and type 2 errors, false positives and false negatives. But the decision is often made in terms of a p-value. The p-value is the probability of obtaining a value of the test statistic at least as extreme as the one that was actually observed, given that the null hypothesis is true. Okay, so that's a little mouthful, but we'll come back to that concept. If the p-value is less than the significance level, then the null hypothesis is rejected. The smaller the p-value, the more significant the result is said to be. The notion of statistical significance, the probability that an experimental result could not have been determined by chance, that should be chance there, and confidence, how sure we are that these results do not occur by chance, are intimately related. Now, let's talk about Japan. Why are we having this catastrophic meltdown in Japan? If they had had a 9.0 earthquake, would we be having this meltdown in Japan?
No.
No. If they'd had a tsunami, would we have had this meltdown in Japan?
No. They did not plan for both things happening at the same time.
They made a conscious decision, as does every other nuclear reactor in the world, that these two events would not occur simultaneously. And they bet wrong. And that's what this is all about. And you will all face these kinds of decisions, and many of these decisions are deeply ethical. When you design products like automobiles, you will come to understand that some people will be killed by the product you're designing. And you'll have to live with that. In almost any kind of manufacturing situation, there's some probability that someone's going to die from your work. Of course, the more extreme cases of this are things like NASA, where they send people up into space and knowing that some of them will never come back. And the reality is we have to manage this with statistics because the implications of these decisions are very significant. And you cannot simply say we will have zero error. So I want to come back to this, but let's go walk through an example which is very close to what you'll face with your experiments you're going to run in senior design. So a coin, we all would agree if I flip a coin and it's a fair coin, there's a 50% chance of landing on heads or tails, correct? Assuming the coin is flipped fairly. There are people who claim they can actually flip coins and catch them such that they can determine the output. But generally speaking, we would expect a fair coin if there's a 50% chance. There was an interesting story about this many years ago when they were casting coins for the Euro coins, They were very concerned about the fact that if they didn't cast the coins right, they would not flip fairly. You don't think about this when you're designing a coin, but it's a big issue. Coins have to be carefully designed so that when they flip, they do in fact flip fairly. So how do we test this in practice? Well, I think if we follow what you tend to do in your senior design reports and presentations, you will flip a coin a small number of times and draw a conclusion, right? So the null hypothesis on this is going to be that the coin is fair and deviations from the 50% rate are due to chance. So suppose that we flip this coin a total of 20 times, and 14 heads come up. Is the coin biased?
Possible.
There's no way to know.
You can make a conclusion, but you need more proof.
You have to have a
more test machine.
Well, I'm glad everybody's agreeing so readily with more data. This is going to be really easy, Dr. Higgins, in a few weeks. So don't give in so easily, because that means you're going to have to run multiple experiments.
Less data. One out of five, kind
of? Do you think we can put some mathematics to this and figure out if, in fact, there's a good chance this coin is biased or unbiased? There actually is a lot of information here.
Yeah, not the right information.
What?
You don't know how many times the coin is like spinning in the air, you don't know.
I said, assuming it's flipped fairly. It spins. It spins 20 times and there's no wind. You know, no appreciable wind, and the person catching the coin, you know, isn't one of these experts who can. So the p-value of this result would be the chance that a fair coin landing on heads or tails at least 14 out of 20 flips, plus the chance of a fair coin plus the alternative. So it could come up 14 heads, it could come up 14 tails. So we have to consider both alternatives. So in this case, I don't want to go in too deep into the analysis of this. You'll find this, I think this actually is on Wikipedia if I remember right. But the distribution obeys a binomial distribution. The probability that we flip that 14 out of 20 times the coin comes up heads can actually be computed as 0.0577. And by symmetry, the alternative is also 0.0577. So the total probability that this would happen is 0.115, 1 out of 10 essentially. But now the question is, you know, we still don't really know, is the coin biased or not? And one of the messages I want to leave you with today that's really important to understand but in experimental design is that there's always a chance something will happen. You know, that there's always a chance that your hypothesis will be true or your hypothesis will be false. You can't really tell from one trial, because there's always a probability that we could have flipped this coin and 20 times it could have come up heads. There's some chance that could happen. So very often when we're doing experimental design, we have to ask questions like, what's the chance if we just randomly flip this coin that this event would happen? How much better is your system than random guessing? That question actually came up on one of our senior design presentations. So generally, one rejects the null hypothesis if the p-value is smaller than or equal to the significance level. and this is often represented by the Greek letter alpha. If the significance level is 0.05, then the results are only 5% likely to be as extraordinary as just seen, given that the null hypothesis is true. So for our example, the null hypothesis is that it's a fair coin. The observation is that we had 14 out of 20 times we got a heads. The probability of this observation is 11%. The calculated p-value, the 11%, exceeds 0.05. So the observation is consistent with the null hypothesis to this 0.05% level of confidence. It falls within the range of what would happen 95% of the time. So this essentially means, in fact, that we fail to reject the null hypothesis at a 5% confidence level, because even though the coin did not fall evenly, the deviation from the expected 50% is not large enough to conclude that this was an that in fact the coin is biased. Now, the easy way to check this, of course, as many of you have said, is more data. Let's go ahead and flip the coin. Let's do 20 trials and then see overall how that happens. And that's generally what we do. And the point of experimental design is to actually figure out how many times you have to run this experiment so that you get a statistically significant result. A common place you see this is in voting. When they report polling numbers in elections, they always say this result is within plus or minus some percentage, 3%, let's say. You'll see this very commonly. You'll see they'll have one candidate is, you know, got 50% of the votes, the other candidate has 49% of the votes, and they'll spend hours and hours talking about this during an election. But at the bottom of the screen, you'll say the accuracy of this thing is plus or minus 3%, which means those two numbers are not statistically different. But they actually designed the experiment to know that if they sample 1,000 people, they can expect a 3% accuracy. And the process of doing this is actually fairly straightforward. Now, in this example, if it turned out we actually had drawn one more heads, if we had 15 out of 20 turn up as heads, the result would have been statistically significant. You can just run through the calculations. But equally important, and this is the thing that always makes statistics tricky, if we were willing to accept a 10% confidence, the 14 result would also be statistically significant. So the question is, what confidence level should we accept? How confident do we want to be about our decisions? Now again, we bring that back to our cement plant. So you as the new engineer tell the boss, well, we want to be 0%, we want to be 100% confident. 0% confidence level, meaning we're, what's wrong with that? That's going to be too expensive. So who sets the confidence level? This is a delicate negotiation between you and the customer. Give me an example where the confidence level is going to be really, where the p-value is going to be really low. Give me an example where they want to be close to 100% confident in their analysis. HIV test? No. Give me an example in the news today where they want to be really confident. The nuclear power plants. If you talk to the statisticians who design these, who contribute to the design of these things, they would tell, you know, they would tell you that as the tsunami is hitting and the earthquake's hitting, that this can't occur statistically. I don't know how much you've been reading about that, but let's talk about Southern California. In the wake of all this, there's been a lot of discussion about Southern California with respect to earthquakes. What's the what's the prognosis for Southern California?
It's over nuclear earthquake, as we were saying. Isn't there a nuclear power plant on a fault line in San Diego?
Something like that, yeah. It's very interesting to watch how people manage this kind of risk. Who's read about California? You know, about earthquake, the likelihood of an earthquake hitting Cal. What are they saying now about the likelihood of a catastrophic earthquake hitting Southern California? How would you answer that question if you were the earthquake expert, knowing now the little bit that you know about statistics? What are some of the, how would you sort of qualify your statement? Well, what they're saying in Southern California is there's a 99% chance that in the next 30 years, an earthquake of magnitude 8 is going to hit Southern California. And they're predicting about 2,000 people will be killed. If a 9.0 earthquake hits Southern California, which for some reason they believe that's not going to be the case, millions of people would be killed. So some people are trying to argue that they should spend hundreds of billions of dollars reinforcing all the buildings in Southern California to withstand a 9.0 earthquake. How do you think that's going over with the real estate owners?
Not so well.
Not so well. They're not going to do it. They're making a choice that a certain number of deaths, which they will presumably cover with their insurance policies, is cheaper. Now, as with all statistics, the problem with all of this is the confidence level. Fortunately, in most of the industries you work in, they'll have pretty good best practices now in terms of what confidence levels you operate at. Some applications, you tolerate lower confidence levels. Low-cost pregnancy tests. What do you think the accuracy on these low-cost pregnancy tests are? Apparently not much better than chance.
They sell a lot of them.
Because the public, the mass public doesn't really understand confidence intervals. And in other industries, you want very high performance. So, for example, in my research area, when we talk about allowing you to gain access to your banking system, authenticating yourself, you want those kinds of systems operating with very, very high confidence levels. Very low confidence intervals, but very high probability that the person who's gaining access is correct. So it's never enough just to say, well, my result is statistically significant. You have to say your result is statistically significant within a certain level of confidence. Anything is possible. So when you flip this coin, any outcome is possible with some probability. So a confidence interval gives an estimated range of values which is likely to include an unknown population parameter. The estimated range being calculated from a given set of sample data. The level C of a confidence interval gives the probability that the interval produced by the method employed includes the true value of the parameter. So let's talk briefly about an example that's a little closer to what you'll be faced with. You may remember doing this kind of thing in your physics labs or your chemistry labs. You measure the boiling temperature of a certain liquid and observe these readings, 102.5, 101, 103, 100, 100, 102, and so forth. Six samples. You calculate the mean to be 101.82. What's actually wrong? I just realized this now. This is your chance to beat up on me. I see this all the time in senior design. What's wrong with this?
Number of significant
digits. That should probably be just 101. Maybe 101.8. Now, if you know that the standard deviation for this procedure is 1.2 degrees, you can then compute the confidence interval for the population mean at a 95% confidence level. In other words, you want to estimate the true mean temperature, the true mean boiling temperature of the liquid, and you also would like some sense of how much that can vary at a 95% confidence level. So what we will typically do is to assume a normal distribution. Now, the problem with a lot of statistical analysis is you always have to estimate things like means and variances. And generally speaking, our estimates of these are inversely proportional to the square root of the number of trials. I don't want to go into great detail on that today, but in a statistics course, you'll learn about this. So that's an important point because ultimately that's going to control the range in which you expect this value to fall at a 95% confidence level. It's going to be inversely proportional to the square root of the number of trials. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Sometimes life kind of sucks. Why is that a bad thing?
Life sucks.
If that was proportional to x squared, to n squared, that would be much better. Why? It's inversely proportional to the variance of your experiment is inversely proportional to the square root of the number of trials. Why is that discouraging? That means you need a lot more trials. If you want to decrease your variance by a factor of 2, how many more trials do you have to run? What number gives you the square root of 2? 4. So that means you have to run four more trials to decrease your variance by a factor of 2. If you run 100 trials, you decrease your variance only by a factor of 10. If that was proportional to n squared, it would be the opposite. You'd get a dramatic reduction in variance for the number of experiments you had to run. So this tells you that you really have to run large amounts of trials to get significant reductions in the variance, and it's not linear. It's according to a square root law. So confidence intervals essentially allow you to assess with what probability will a result fall within the mean of your Gaussian or your normal distribution. And you may have heard terms like z-statistics, and that's essentially where this stuff comes from. So here we depict, if we have a 95% confidence interval, you would expect the result to fall in that shaded red area, and you'd be within that confidence. So, for example, when you take a measurement, and then when you measure the mean and variance of a normal distribution, and so let's say the mean is 0, and the standard deviation is 1. What does that mean in terms of the amount of area under that Gaussian curve between minus 1 and plus 1? People talk about, well, that result was within one standard deviation. What does that mean in terms of the area under the curve for a normal distribution? What does that mean for the probability that your measurement falls within minus 1 to plus 1? If you have a normal distribution, mean 0, variance 1. One standard deviation is within 66%. Two standard deviations is 90%. Three standard deviations is 95%. What is a popular quality control theory? Six Sigma. Where does Six Sigma come from? The idea of trying to design processes so that the defect rates are below six standard deviations from the mean, which means you're talking about defect rates on the order of one in a million. So the Z value, and you often hear people talk about the Z test, essentially represents the point on this curve such that the probability of observing a value greater than Z is equal to P, and that's essentially what a Z test is. And what we, the example we went through is essentially a demonstration of that. So all of this relates back to the properties of these Gaussian or normal distributions. So for example, the value of Z such that the probability of a measurement is less than 0.025 or greater than 0.975 is equal to 1.96. So you can essentially trade the confidence interval for the range of variation. So coming back to our measurement of boiling temperature, if you just focus on the blue highlighted text, from that data you can predict that if you want to consider your 95% confidence level on your estimate of the mean, that mean would have to fall within the range of 100 and 102, 100.86 and 102.78. If you want to have a 90% confidence that your measurement falls within the mean, that measurement would have to be between 101.01 and 102.63. So you can see that as you're willing to tolerate less confidence, the range of allowable range for your measurements increases. And that's sort of a general rule of thumb. So when you run your experiments, when you do your testing, and you report on this in your final presentations, we want to see you running multiple tests. And we want to see some analysis of the variance of those tests. And of course, that takes time. Now, in these lecture notes, there's a couple more pages on ways you deal with things like unknown mean and unknown variance. I don't want to dwell on that today, but we can help you, and certainly your advisors can help you with these kinds of things. There's a nice URL here that has a very nice set of notes on testing and experimental design and statistical significance. Consult with your advisors as you're designing your tests. Most of your advisors are very, very knowledgeable about statistics because they have to do this for their research work and their research papers and such. And these notes, there's a more expanded version of these notes there as well. But the main thing is plan on running multiple experiments. That's why we want for this second hardware review, hopefully after that you pass that point, you'll spend the rest of the time in the course actually testing your systems. If you leave testing to the night before, you're not going to get there. Okay, any questions or issues before we break? All right, see you next week.